This week on Your Western Context, a fake protest at Meng Wanzhou's extradition hearing raises questions. The UCP ties advanced education funding to performance, and a petition against Trudeau's gun ban reaches 100,000 signatories. Also, Trudeau visits a local donut shop and social media goes crazy. This is Western Context, episode 153, recorded Friday, January 24th, 2020. Fake protests and scandals. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context 153, roughly culminating in 3 years since we first started this venture back in January of 2017, 153 episodes in, and we're still providing all the information and context that the media doesn't in their stories each and every week on this podcast.
That's for sure, and I think we can all say that it's been kind of a slow news week this past week, but there's certainly still been lots going on in Canada to talk about, and lots that we can talk about on this podcast that hasn't been reported very much by all outlets that they could have been talking about instead, but certainly some very head-scratching stories to come up in our show this week.
Yeah, definitely. And if you're joining us for the first time, we are a podcast that aims to cut through all the media bias and sensationalism that you find when you're reading the news, wherever it might be, as you'll see in our stories this weekend. In doing so, we hope to provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And we're going to begin focusing on a story relating to Huawei, which is something that we're going to be hearing a lot about this year. So let's begin.
Yes, that's right. This story takes place mainly in Vancouver, but honestly, it's a story that should have interest to all Canadians because it comes down to our security and our technology going forward and the influence that a gigantic country has on our country. And on Monday, Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou was at the law courts in Vancouver to have an extradition hearing. And outside, there were a group of students holding up hastily made signs that all looked like they were written by the same person. And at least a number of them thought that they were in a movie shoot, and one was a real Vancouver actor who was actually duped by a third party into attending the protest. Now, Julia Hackstaff, who is an actor in Victoria, or Vancouver rather, she says that she thought she was performing as an extra in a film shoot, not actually attending a real protest. And she says it took her about half a minute to realize that the reporter asking her questions was actually a real reporter and not actually an actor, and she left very quickly after that. She said that she genuinely believed that she was showing up for a film shoot and thought it was odd that the group of young performers weren't actually given any directions before the cameras started rolling. And that's because it wasn't actually a film shoot. It was a real court session that was happening, and it was a protest that was created by someone that we don't know. Now, the high-profile extradition case of Meng Wanzhou has increased tensions between Canada and China after Meng was detained at Vancouver International Airport in December of 2018 and then arrested at the request of the United States. China then detained two Canadian citizens who had been living in China, Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor. Now, some Canadian commentators have called for Canada to release Meng in order to secure the release of Spavor Kovrig. But speaking to reporters in Winnipeg on Monday, Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland said that the Canadian government's priority is the well-being and release of the two Canadians detained by China, Kovrig and she said, "Our government has been clear that we're a rule of law country and that we honor our extradition treaty commitments. That is what we need to do, and that is what we will do," she told reporters in Winnipeg. Now, amidst the media circus surrounding the extradition trial, a group of young protesters stood out, especially to reporters. On Monday, the reporters noticed that the group of young people standing with hastily made signs that read, "Bring Michael home," and "Trump stop bullying us," and "Free Miss Meng, equal justice." And It honestly looked like all of the signs were created by the same person. Quite clearly, whoever it was that tried to organize it in the first place. Now, as first reported by Bob Mackin and TheBreaker.News, one young man told an independent filmmaker that he'd been told that he'd be paid $100 to be in a music video shoot. The man refused to give his name or appear on camera, but in an audio recording, he can be heard saying that when he showed up at the courthouse and saw a lot of cameras, he assumed it was for the music video shoot that he'd been told about. He said when there were all these cameras and stuff, for a long time I believed I was filming a scene where someone was coming out of a car, and then the reporters started showing up and I was like, I don't really feel great about this anymore. And then he decided to leave. He said that he decided to stick around for a while and hold a sign in hopes of getting the payment that he was promised. But when he started to ask around about getting the $100, there was a merry-go-round of non-answers. Now, Hackstaff's story is quite similar. She said that she heard from an acquaintance that she knows on Facebook of a Monday morning job to be a background actor at the courthouse, and the offer came over Facebook from a person in the acting community that she has never met before, and the pay, similarly, would be $100, which she never received. Another in the group said that was at the court to call for equal justice, but then admitted that he didn't know the details of the case, or that it was about the United States attempting to extradite Meng to face fraud charges, and he didn't know who Huawei was, didn't know who Meng Wanzhou was, and didn't know what the case was about. Now, another person said that she was recruited by a friend promising a $150 payday just to show up at the courthouse and hold a sign. Afterwards, she went home and she Googled Huawei and Meng Wanzhou and felt deep regret for showing up at the protest, saying that she had no idea what was going on or what the court case was actually about. Now, at the same time as the protest going, or the fake protest rather, going on at the courthouse, an unrelated group of Uyghur protesters against China's jailing of millions of Muslims in Xinjiang were outside Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou's Shaughnessy mansion on Monday morning. But this isn't it for this bizarre story. It turns out that the court-approved security company that monitors Meng Wanzhou has also been working for the People's Republic of China consulate. Now, that is according to Ivy Lee, who is a member of a pro-Hong Kong group which has protested outside the Granville Street consular mansion. She calls it very unsettling. Video, which was shot last September by documentary filmmaker Ina Mitchell and aired on CTV News Vancouver, showed two Lionsgate Risk Management Group Limited employees standing outside the mansion during an anti-government protest. Now, one of them is the same bodyguard who regularly escorts Meng to her BC Supreme Court dates. And Lee said, they're hiring the same people that they're supposed to be watching to ensure that Meng Wanzhou is not going to flee the country, but then they hire the same people to observe the protesters at the anti-China rally. And she said, this is worth looking into. What kind of potential conflict of interest is there? Why is the security company and the same persons that are playing different roles, and how are they going to balance those roles, and what is the reason for doing it? Now, back in December 2018, as part of Meng's bail conditions, Justice William Irk agreed to her lawyer's recommendation and appointed Lionsgate as Meng's round-the-clock security detail. Lionsgate's job is to ensure that Meng does not go home to China and to report to court while awaiting extradition to face fraud charges in the United States. And Meng is responsible for paying Lionsgate. Now, retired RCMP Superintendent Gary Clement, who is now a security consultant and private investigator in Ontario, said that it doesn't pass the smell test. He says, quote, it's a conflict of interest, and I would think that they would have to get clearance from the court. The objectivity around ensuring that she remains in the country and ensuring that she appears in court, that, in my view, has to have an arm's length from China. Now, meanwhile, at the same time as the fake protest as well as the very real protest happening at Meng's mansion in Vancouver, arguments wrapped up January 23rd in the first four-day hearing to determine whether Meng should be extradited to face fraud charges in the U.S. Canadian government lawyers on behalf of the U.S. say that there is ample evidence that Meng lied to HSBC in 2013 to hide the fact of a Huawei subsidiary doing business in Iran in defiance of international sanctions. And that's the point that should be made here, is not that she was defying the international sanctions herself, but that she was lying to HSBC and defrauding a company to hide the fact of Huawei doing this. Now, Meng's lawyers say that she should be freed because the Canadian fraud law is different from the U.S. and that the case is really about sanctions that no longer apply between Canada and Iran. Now, among the observers in the gallery at the law courts was Tong Xiaoling, who is the consul general in Vancouver, as well as Hu Qiaokin, who is the local head of the Communist Party's United Front Foreign Influence Campaign. But for who exactly the person was who hired the young people to act as protesters on Meng's behalf, no one really knows, and only educated guesses at a coordinated propaganda campaign to free Meng can even scratch the surface on this bizarre story.
And, you know, that's exactly it. Scratch the surface on a very bizarre story. And, you know, for casual observers within Canada, this would appear to be a very, very bizarre story. But the fact of the matter is that anytime you're dealing with China and the Communist Party of China, this is precisely how they operate. They have operatives in foreign countries that can stage things like the protests that we saw in this story, which is pictured in our picture of the week at westerncontext.ca. And we also need to realize is that Meng Wanzhou won her bail agreement. She has the monitoring assigned to her and the security firm to make sure that she doesn't leave the country. And as you mentioned, she lives in a mansion in a very, very expensive neighborhood in Vancouver. Meanwhile, you have the two Michaels who are detained in China, and this is the word the media uses, detained, when in reality, they're in prison. They face very awkward confinements. In some cases, it's been reported that they're in cells that they can't turn the lights out and they're filled with light 24 hours a day, which really does a number to the human body over a number of days and weeks. And it's just a brutal, brutal treatment that China is inflicting on these two people detained there, while the Huawei CFO, Meng Wanzhou, is free to roam around Vancouver, live life in one of the most peaceful and generous countries in the world as she won bail through our court system. And that's something that the media misses all the time when they talk about her. And, you know, I think we're on the right path of educated guesses as to what it could be in terms of what brought these protests together. But you really have to ask at this point, when is public pressure going to step up that the government do something against Huawei and, you know, take a firmer stance in the Meng Wanzhou case? And, you know, you read in the newspapers and whatnot, you have people who are saying that we should just give her back to China for the sake of diplomacy to mess with what the U.S. is doing with their own foreign policy. And, you know, that might be one way of looking at it. But the other way of looking at it is that she did commit a crime. And we have an extradition treaty with the U.S., who is one of our biggest allies. And it is something that Canada must do to honor that. And there's just so many moving parts of the story that the media misses what's actually happening here at the end of the day. And that is the fact that China is trying to assert its dominance in the Western world, both with these protests and the Huawei 5G technology that we're going to see start coming online in the next few years and various cell phone providers. What, for what it's worth, Rogers is a company that's looking at using Ericsson for their 5G technology, not Huawei, whereas both TELUS and Bell are looking at using Huawei, and that's something that the federal government is going to look at. So for Canadians who want to support a company that has no intention of looking at Huawei, Rogers is probably the way to go in this. But this is just story just reeks of the awareness that needs to be brought forward when a country like Canada ends up dealing with China.
Exactly. Just the whole thing around the fake protests where the young people really didn't even know what was going on, that they were promised, you know, a sum of money just to appear, and that, or that they thought they were being in a film shoot. You know, it just goes to show that they'll do whatever they can to try and get public press on their side. But it was quickly ferreted out by the reporters that were there that clearly something was wrong and something was going on with this protest. And it just goes to show that if it didn't happen like that, if the reporters weren't there, who knows what could have happened. And these people could have been part of a bigger protest that wasn't actually a protest. And, you know, this is something that China does all the time. They try and do the propaganda campaigns to get the Western world on their side. And if money doesn't do it, they try and do that with information. And, you know, this is something we've seen before, and hopefully we won't see it again. But as Meng Wanzhou is still going through her extradition hearing, we'll probably see more craziness surrounding this story.
Yeah, it's certainly not over, especially as the government needs to make that Huawei decision probably at some point this year. And that's something we'll definitely be watching here at Western Context. And if you want to help us do that, you can visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/Western Context. And you can support the podcast monetarily there if you so choose to. For $2 a month, the price of a cup of coffee, you continue to help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media, as well as produce the podcast. For $5 a month, or probably the price of a sandwich, a good sandwich, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the media, and you can also have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the week. And in case you're wondering what we're going to be doing with that, when we reach $25 a month in contributions, you can expect 2 Patreon exclusive articles for you guys, the listeners out there, expanding on coverage of our show stories throughout the month. And these articles will continue to provide the context and information that you've come to expect from us. At $50 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month, where we'll reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs might be headed next. And we also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can do at westerncontext.ca/support. We're going to move on to Alberta right now, and this is a story that generally received a good amount of positive praise, but there was the negative praise, of course, that overshadowed it, and that is the fact that Alberta post-secondary funding will inevitably become tied to performance. And, you know, people are probably wondering, what exactly does that mean? Does that mean how well the students do? Does that mean how well the professors are rated? So with this, each institution will have their own priorities, and there will be system-wide targets that are set by the provincial government. Now, Advanced Education Minister Dimitrios Nikolaidis said that there are indeed several indicators that the government would like to see, which will include things like graduation and completion rates, graduate employment, experiential learning, enrollment, both domestic and international, commercialization of intellectual property, research capacity, quality of teaching and student experience and student satisfaction. And this isn't going to be something that's going to start in the next year or so. This is starting on April 1st. On April 1st, Campus Alberta grants that provide about 40% of the funding will be tied to these incoming metrics. And what this means is that if an institution, say the University of Alberta, were to meet only 90% of their targets, they would only receive 90% of their funding. And with this, starting in April, 15% of the funding tied to these measures will be related into the metrics that the province is going to lay out, with this going up to the full 40% by 2022 and 2023. Council of Alberta University Students Chair Sadia Nazir said that their organization is cautiously optimistic about this, but that the metrics that ultimately get put in place need to make sure that they don't negatively impact students. Grant Kohler, also with the Alberta Students Executive Council, said that this represents a change that is making his organization excited. In particular, he said that it's going to force institutions and administration to really start thinking a little bit more closely on what they're spending money on, what strategic directions they're going to be doing going towards, and which will ultimately save students, institutions, and taxpayers money. Now, in the past year, we've talked about university institutions having wide-ranging bureaucracies that rival governments. And, you know, with that, that's something that the province will want to tackle, because the entire government of Alberta under the new United Conservative Party is looking for ways to find savings and effectively reduce the size of government in this. Now, when we hear about this in the media most of the time, we see that universities are complaining about funding. And we've talked many times before about this, how they were concerned that they wouldn't get the funding that they would need to continue on with their programs. And we've talked about how they should look inward to becoming more efficient and providing their core aspects that they are providing to the province of Alberta, in particular teaching and research. Now, there's also a fear with this that institutions could get caught up in a downward spiral of negative metrics, and this would make it, that the institutions could make it easier for students to graduate, just so that the institution would hit targets instead of actually trying to improve the situation in those institutions going forward. But for those concerned, they feel that this is some kind of radical policy that wasn't talked about in the election campaign last spring, but in actuality, it's right there. If you look at the UCP platform document, they promise to, quote, measure labor market outcomes of post-secondary programs to identify the correlation between provincial subsidies and economic returns for taxpayers. And if you parse that sentence out, it effectively means that university institutions should be providing a good enough education that those who are going to university should have a positive labor market to work with after their post-secondary program, and that the amount of money in terms of provincial subsidies should be seen in such a way that it is providing an economic benefit for taxpayers. So that one bullet point in the platform is this entire move right here that we're seeing. The platform also promised to establish the most effective intellectual property framework for the commercialization and entrepreneurial application of innovative research and development from Alberta's universities and colleges. What this effectively means is that the government wants the research and educational institutions in Alberta, the universities and colleges, and even technical schools, to effectively come up with new forms of technology that can be marketed not only within Alberta, but within the country and throughout the entire world, which in turn, at the end of the day, will bring investment back to Alberta, assuming these university graduates continue to stay in the province and work at companies where they're applying what they've learned in the province. These changes put forward by the government tick all the boxes on these two platform commitments that was made in the campaign last spring. The UCP also promised to bring forward new regulations that require universities and colleges to comply with free speech policies that are consistent with the University of Chicago statement on principles of free expression. And this was done last year, last summer in particular, is one of the very early things that the UCP started working on. And by December 2019, the institutions in Alberta had already taken steps to make this a reality. Now, this shouldn't be a shock to anyone, and, you know, some people might indeed find it a shock, but the government is doing exactly what they said that they were going to do in this case regarding universities and advanced education, and people shouldn't be shocked. People need to realize that elections have consequences, and these reforms are one of them. This is what people voted for. No one in the media or at any of these institutions should be surprised by this. And in fact, we even had some examples on social media this week where people were criticizing the advanced education minister for bringing out these changes, because they felt that somebody shouldn't necessarily be making changes with how universities work without having the experience of university. And he said, not only did I go to a university, and I'm paraphrasing what the minister said here, but effectively what the minister said is that he went to university, but he also taught political science and has a PhD in political science from a university and has taught. And with that, he knows exactly how university operations work. And this is something that we saw with the Alberta cabinet that, you know, if you look across the country, you don't see much of very often. You don't see governments that effectively put forward cabinets that have people who feel real-world experience. And we talked about this when this government was sworn in. The agriculture minister is a farmer. The education minister is a former school trustee. And here we see the advanced education minister's credentials coming through with making these changes in terms of university administration. And this is something that I think many Albertans who voted for the UCP will be happy to see happening.
Yeah, I think something with this entire story here is it's just going further to help ease the burden of the cost of university. And I think anyone that's gone to university across the country will know that tuition, even things like textbooks, even the mandatory fees that you have to pay to student unions and all the other things that go along with that have just risen exponentially over the last 40 years or so. And you have to ask yourself if the quality of education that you're getting is really worth the extra cost. And a lot of people have to make that sacrifice as to what they're going to do for their future. And a lot of jobs these days, they require certain degrees, and a lot of time you have to get into a lot of debt to actually get into the field that you want to go. And for the Alberta government trying to reduce the overhead that these universities are costing, it just goes to show that they're going through with their plan that they were going to try and reduce the costs on these universities and try and reduce the amount of money that they have been spending and the amount of overhead that, as you said, can even rival governments in what they're doing. Just to pass that along to taxpayers as well, it can only be regarded as a good thing. But as you said, anytime anyone tries to change something with education, the pitchforks automatically come out. But if they look at what's actually been going on, I think they should know that something needed to be fixed with the universities.
Yeah, and anybody who's dealt with the administration of a university that functions more like a bureaucracy than a way to help students or has had a really shoddy professor will see this and should be pleased with these changes that are going to come forward with that. So with that being said, we're going to move on to our Canada story involving Bill Blair, the public safety minister, and gun control.
Yeah, that's for sure. An online petition on ourcommons.ca against the ineffective and money-wasting Trudeau Liberal gun ban has accumulated over 100,000 signatures and is now the second largest in Canadian history. Now, Public Safety Minister Bill Blair is overseeing the buyback program, which Blair estimates could cost anywhere between $400 and $600 million. And what this was going to do is effectively ban what the Liberal government calls military-style assault rifles. And what that actually is, we don't really know because there's no definition of military-style assault rifle. But in essence, it's going to try and get legal gun owners to give back their either semi-automatic rifles to the government. Now, the petition was initiated by Alberta resident Bradley Manziak, and this was also sponsored by Medicine Hat's Conservative MP Glenn Motz, who had this to say on the petition. He said, quote, "I'm always pleased to help Canadians voice their concerns, especially on such a deeply flawed policy like the Liberals' misguided approach on firearms policy that ignore criminals and instead focuses on law-abiding Canadian firearms owners. It is unfortunate that tens of thousands of Canadians feel ignored, maligned, and even demonized by the Liberals to the extent that this petition was even necessary." And he also said, "Canadians expect policies that focus on stopping criminals, gangs, and the flow of illegal firearms into Canada, not policies that attack law-abiding Canadians' firearm owners. Canadians want clear, honest policies based on facts and evidence, but the Liberals' firearm policy just makes it clear that they are intent on ignoring the evidence and will pursue public safety policies that do nothing to make Canadians safer." Now, this has been echoed by the RCMP themselves. Winnipeg Police Constable Rob Carver calls the gun ban nonsense, and he says when we seize handguns, the handguns are almost always 100% in the possession of people who have no legal right to possess them. They're almost always stolen or illegally obtained. And he says that he doesn't see how, as a 27-year-old veteran of the force, how adding another layer of law will make any difference anywhere in this country. Now, even Trudeau's own party doesn't see the point in a feel-good gun ban. Thunder Bay's Liberal MP Marcus Pawlowski wrote a letter to Public Safety Minister Bill Blair, dated January 16th, that included worries about the, quote, military assault gun ban not making sense as a coherent firearm policy, given that there is no actual definition of what an assault rifle is. Pawlowski's letter reads, quote, over the course of the past 3 months, I have heard a wide variety of views on this proposed ban. I believe it is my role to ensure that these views are brought to your attention for consideration. Now, the term assault rifle, as we mentioned, was created by the anti-gun lobby in the U.S. to demonize full automatic guns, but it now simply includes everything that looks scary. Now, Pawlowski continued with his letter. He said, given that there is currently no legal definition for a military assault rifle in Canada, some community members I've spoken with are skeptical that a ban based on this term would make sense as a coherent firearm policy. Such a term, as they see it, is more political than policy-oriented and seeks to target certain firearms without a rational basis. For some hunters in my writing, a ban on military-style firearms would seem to arbitrarily target one firearm over another based on their appearance. Now, Pawlowski has since retracted the letter and says that he's fully on board with the Liberals' gun policy, saying that, quote, he's not going cowboy on this one, and that he's, quote, not a gun enthusiast, but he's just passing on the views of his constituents, as is his job as an MP. Now, however, it should be noted that even Bill Blair has rapidly changing views on the matter. In a CBC interview in the summer of 2018, before he was introduced into cabinet, Blair said that most of the gun crime is committed by illegal handguns smuggled in from the U.S., and he was skeptical of a gun ban being effective in combating gun crime. But as we know, his position has changed drastically once he was appointed to cabinet by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau as the public safety minister. At this point, we should remember that Bill Blair was also the architect behind one of Canada's most infamous police brutality events, the G20 summit in Toronto. And really, we have to ask ourselves, is someone who approves of police brutality someone you want in charge of taking guns away from law-abiding citizens? Now, it's true what he says, handguns are the firearm of choice for most shootings. Semi-autos only make up a small percentage of rifles and shotguns in our country. So how does this add up to a federal ban costing $600 million in taxpayer money? The short answer is that it doesn't. Canada has roughly 2.2 million licensed gun owners who are monitored daily by RCMP for red flags, and a lot of people don't know that because it's called continuous eligibility screening. So if you step out of the line with the law, the cops show up to your place and they take your guns if you're on that list. Now, if only 5% of Canadian gun owners were out there shooting up the streets, they would have 110,000 deaths on their hands annually. But according to StatsCan, 2018 left Canada with just 249 tragic gun murders. Now, the vast majority were by gangs fighting over drugs in urban centers. Now, the lives lost in those incidences are valuable, and 249 Canadian families are feeling daily pain from it, and something needs to change on that issue. Gang warfare can't go unchecked, but to punish millions of innocent Canadians who hold such an excellent track record will not help, and there's a very simple truth to all this. Taking firearms away from a rural owner in the Yukon or Alberta or BC will not prevent gang homicide in Toronto, which is where by far the largest number of gun homicides occur. Now, there's another note to this as well that should be made. 10 years ago, before he was party leader, Justin Trudeau falsely claimed that the Liberals didn't want to confiscate guns. He said, nobody wants to take your guns. We just want you to register them. This was in talking about the long gun registry that was brought out by, I believe it was the Martin Liberals. But at the time, he said that Canadians were all right with having guns because we grew up in a gun culture. And I believe he said at the time that no one wants to take away the gun of a person who just wants to go out to the woods once in a while and do some hunting. But now he's literally pushing the largest, most authoritarian gun confiscation in Canadian history without even bothering to vote on it in the House of Commons. The way he's planning on doing this is to enact the ban with an order in council, which bypasses both debate and consultation, as well as the parliamentary vote to put legislation into effect immediately, with absolutely no public or political recourse whatsoever. So at the end of the day, there'll be no debate, there'll be no vote, there'll be no consultation, not even from the RCMP. And mainstream outlets add a fuel to this fire as well. We've seen countless times again from media outlets all across the news spectrum, from Global News to CTV to CBC, even the National Post and other respective outlets have been forced to print retractions after outraged gun owners forced them to respond to the misinformation. And it's hard to say if these incidents are deliberate, but there sure does seem to be a pattern forming. If you set the topic aside, what we have on our hands here is an outright media bias misinforming the public and administration using this dynamic to pass highly authoritarian legislation under false pretenses without even bothering to vote on it. So I think it's safe to say that's not the Canada we want to live in. And Justin Trudeau claims that this is about making Canadians safer. But the author of this article asks the question, does anyone honestly see a safer society forming since he took over? It's probably not. We've seen a lot of division. We've seen a lot of fracture. And with this gun ban, we'll see a lot of growing hate, especially from rural to urban.
And, you know, when it comes down to it at the end of this story, the gun ban, especially around the assault rifles, as they're called, it's simply a feel-good measure that's copy and pasted outside of American policy that many people feel is needed in Canada. And, you know, I think the most telling thing about this story is if you go back to the point where before Bill Blair was in cabinet, being the chief of police from Toronto, Canada's largest city, he would know what the statistics on this are. And by saying that, you know, most of the gun crime is committed by illegal handguns smuggled from the U.S. and he was skeptical of a gun ban being acceptable, those are the words of somebody who is on the ground and has access to information or had access to information and knew the way that the trend was going in Toronto, at least from when he was police chief. But now you can see that the position changed to be a purely political position. And that's not something Canadians want in this day and age. They want authenticity. They want to know exactly what the government is doing. And they want a government that responds to the needs of the population, whether that be adding clarity for Huawei or, in this case, actually instituting a sane firearms policy that works. Because this doesn't seem sane at all.
No, it doesn't seem sane at all. And just the fact that they're going after legal gun owners on this, when it's quite clear that the problem is created from illegal handguns that are smuggled in from the United States and from a lot of the cities that are around Toronto, in fact, it just goes to show that the Liberals are way off base on this issue and they're not actually doing anything about the real issue. Instead, what they're doing is spending a lot of money to create a buyback program for legal owners that, once again, have to go through a daily check as to whether they've been in trouble with the law or not. And it just makes no sense whatsoever. And the RCMP doesn't think it makes sense. The police chiefs don't think it makes sense. And certainly a lot of rural hunters and people that actually use these firearms don't think it makes sense. So it just goes to show that the only way that they can actually push this piece of legislation through is to put it in through an order in council. And That seems to be the way that this Trudeau government is going, because the only way that they can get it through is with the help of another party, after all, in a minority government situation. So they don't want to see this sort of thing going into Parliament, because then there'll be more attention on it. And the fact that they are trying to push this through without attention just goes to show that the media needs to be talking about this more.
That's right. And, you know, speaking of attention, that's exactly what our firing line story is about. The firing line is a story where something gets completely blown out of the water for good or for bad, most of the time for bad, and the media picks up and runs with it, and in most cases is completely wrong on that. And this headline says that Canadians criticize Trudeau after visit to O'Donuts Bakery in Winnipeg. Now, Trudeau is holding a cabinet retreat in Winnipeg, and it made international news for all the wrong reasons. Yes, this did indeed reach CNN, believe it or not. This is the kind of firing line segment that we often see here at Western Context. And many people suggested that the Prime Minister should have just went to Tim Hortons instead, because the headline that was graced with this is that, oh, Donuts actually sells boxes, dozen of donuts, that's worth $47 a box, whereas if you go to Tim Hortons, you can get one for $9.99. And let's be real here. Tim Hortons is an institution in Canada, and given the way that the modern world works, it doesn't necessarily mean that it deserves its place. Many people are often looking for alternatives to Tim Hortons because of either bad service or missing products, or quite frankly, they just want to support a company that is Canadian-owned, because believe it or not, Tim Hortons is owned by a Brazilian company. The parent company is, rather. Now, on Tuesday, the Prime Minister posted a photo online of him carrying boxes of donuts from the local donut shop, O'Donuts, in Winnipeg, and this set off a flurry of reporting both on social media and a number of news outlets. And we'll get into what exactly happened with this in just a moment. Now, this business is a small local shop in Winnipeg. It employs about 30 people who are Canadians, legal Canadian workers, not temporary workers, as Tim Hortons and other fast food companies have done in the past. These workers receive full benefits and are paid above minimum wage. And in fact, the website and Twitter account for O'Donuts highlights that the workers at O'Donuts are actually paid a living wage, which is something that many believe that the government should strive for and to implement. But here we are, we see a small business that is actually able to proceed and sell products at high margins, because, I mean, $47 at the high end for a box of donuts, which is the number that we're using here because this is what was parroted in the media, but we'll get to the actual cost of what the Prime Minister paid in just a little bit. It wasn't $47. But this is a Canadian company that is doing well, being successful, and that success is enough to have that company be able to pay their workers a living wage. And you might be wondering, what exactly is a living wage? We often hear the term minimum wage, which for all intents and purposes is a wage floor, which means a company can't pay their workers anything less than that. But a living wage is at some point a number where someone has, in theory, who is doing work at a company that's paying them a living wage, they have enough money to purchase food, purchase housing, and ultimately live a comfortable life if it's just that one person. That's what a living wage is. The business also touts their use of local ingredients, which in turn supports local farmers, which is a huge deal in Manitoba. The business also employs a tactic seen in the current retail landscape, which could only be described as shrinking. We see many companies in Canada packing up and moving away because of the online market, and you need to have something special in Canada in this day and age, and probably in the Western world, to have success at a brick-and-mortar business. And, you know, Canada is dominated by large corporations, and everybody likes seeing local businesses, and in particular small businesses, succeed. And that's what's happening in this case. And that tactic is providing a value for all consumers, but also providing a premium product experience. This is what Apple has done to find its success in the mobile phone market and computer market. Of course, they sell products that most everybody can afford. But if you really want to, you can go for the ultimate high end and buy the most expensive smartphone out there from Apple. And the idea is that there's a choice. You can either take part and engage in a business, in particular O Donuts or Apple, that has a good customer service experience and is, in the case of O Donuts, staffed by local workers. And on the other hand, if you're looking for a very premium product, that's something that both O Donuts and Apple employ. And this is what both companies have seemingly done to find success in the ever-changing retail market here in Canada. Now, the downside of this, though, is that headlines surface both domestically and internationally. Internationally, in a CNN opinion piece stating that the Prime Minister paid $47 per box for his donuts, and he bought 7 boxes on this. And, you know, doing the math on that, if you bought 7 boxes of donuts at $47 each, that's $329 on donuts. Whereas if you look at what media outlet True North said, if you were instead to go to Tim Hortons and you were to buy those same 7 boxes of donuts, a dozen donuts for $9.99, you could do that for about $70. Now, the story took social media by storm, with Canadians expressing disgust and outrage at the thought that the Prime Minister was spending this much money on extravagant donuts for his cabinet. There was also the opinion piece that was published at CNN with the headline that said, Trudeau's $4 donuts cost him dearly, and the PM has handed Canadians another reason to ridicule him. Now, the catch in all this, though, is that Twitter forgot, and the media also forgot before they ran with their stories and ran to hit the publish button, that O Donut actually sells donuts that are cheaper than $4 per donut. And it turned out, as was given by a statement from the company, that the donuts that Justin Trudeau bought came out to about $2.60 each. And this was that with a substantial discount that he got by purchasing online in bulk. And they say that, you know, normally our cheapest donut is $3.25, and they do go up to $4. So, well, yes, this is more expensive than Tim Hortons. The donuts weren't $47 for a dozen. They come out to around $31 a box. The appropriateness for purchasing donuts at roughly $30 a dozen is something that should be left to Canadians to ponder when it comes time to cast judgment on the Prime Minister. But that can't happen if nobody knows the exact cost, and if the media runs rampant with social media tweets in an effort to publish their story and amp up the story without getting the full context of what actually happened in this case. And let's look back to something similar. Back in 2012, Harper government heritage minister Bev Otis stayed at the Savoy in London, hired a limousine, and ordered orange juice at a price of $16 a glass, and the media vilified her for this, and she ultimately resigned. And we're not hearing any push from the media to have anybody from the cabinet resign in this case, or anyone close to the Prime Minister on this. But back then, the story was about Bev Otis and the government's response. But today, everything on this story is focused on social media, and much of the gist of this story was lost. And in this case, Canadians have no idea about how angry they actually should have been with this. Because looking at this, you know, if you read the headlines online on social media, or you look at various reporting done in global news, you would think that this is a huge travesty. But at the end of the day, it wasn't the cost that many online had thought it was, and it was a bit less. Granted, yes, still expensive, and that's something that Canadians should consider when it's time to cast judgment on the Prime Minister and his cabinet. But the fault of this lies squarely with the mainstream media, and everyone needs to, of course, remember that social media is one of the biggest breeders of fake news out there, and that's what we witnessed this week with this firing line.
Yeah, exactly. When the story came up, I saw it and I dismissed it as a story that really didn't need to be talked about. But then suddenly it blew up on social media and everyone was talking about it. And it seemed like a story that really was a big non-issue. And the fact that social media was getting the facts wrong, and then suddenly international news is talking about it as the latest big scandal from Canada. And really, it's just a, you know, few boxes of donuts that are being bought from a local business that actually supports its workers and actually provides a premium product, which, you know, if you're getting food, you know, a lot of people like to get food that actually tastes good. And a lot of people on Twitter suggesting that he go to Tim Hortons instead. that's like saying, he's working at, he's going to a local burger shop, and then someone asking, well, why didn't you just go to McDonald's instead? You know, it's the same argument, and it doesn't make much sense. And I think another story that came about was actually talking about the people on Twitter that were talking about this, and the fact that a lot of mainstream outlets rushed to publish a story on this to try and create controversy. It kind of fell flat in the end, because the only people that were talking about it after a while was the foreign media, and even there, they were trying to try and create some controversy about this. But in the end, I mean, whether he should have paid a bunch of money for 7 boxes of donuts or whether he shouldn't have, that's for the Canadian public to decide. But at the end, you know, both the Bevota case and this one were completely blown out of proportion, and quite clearly something else should have been talked about, but this was the story. This was the headlining story of the week that was shared across every news outlet, and that's what happened in Canada apparently this week.
Yeah, and you know, there's very clear examples of this. You look at this and you're saying, how can the Canadian media cover anything fairly in this case? And you know, we saw the exact same thing with the federal election this past fall. You know, once again, scandal out of nowhere. And we actually talked about this, I think it was last week or the week before, in the firing line, is that, you know, you see stories like this, you see stories in our firing line each and every week. You really have to ask, what is the Canadian media fit to cover, and what would happen should they be put into a situation where they need to cover something that is actually very deadly and that Canadians need to know all the facts about, say a war, for example? What would happen in that case? Granted, thankfully, we haven't been in that situation in a long time since Afghanistan, but still, it's a question that should terrify the Canadians out there, that the media really isn't showing their best. And if they're not doing it for this, and how are they going to be able to be trusted when we do actually need them to press on and provide all the facts that are needed?
Yeah, and I think one final note that we can make on this story is that the media was covering this without all the facts, and it was talking about what they thought was a potential scandal around Trudeau, and quite frankly, this isn't really a scandal whatsoever.
Nope.
But what could be said is that they have done the same similar level of reporting for actual scandals that have involved the Prime Minister. We could have talked about the India trip. We could talk about the blackface that showed up last year. We could talk about any number of programs that he is pushing forward, including the gun buyback, that hasn't been talked about in the mainstream media. And yet, here they were rushing to talk about him buying donuts. And just the fact that the level of trust in media at Canada is at an all-time low, I think we're starting to see why.
Yep, and that's why we're here doing Western Context each and every week. And I don't think there's much else to summarize with that. We do, of course, have a word of the week. I realize that was a rather important note to end on in that regard, striking the importance of the podcast. But nonetheless, what's our word of the week?
So our word of the week this week is buyback, which is defined as a program by government to purchase privately owned firearms to reduce the number of firearms owned by civilians. And we've seen buybacks happen in the past. New Zealand and Australia and even Great Britain have gone through their own buybacks. But Canada doing their own one coming up here, which is going to cost over $500 million. We'll see just how it works and how effective it will be. And certainly lots of stories that were talked about this week. Some weren't covered fairly. Some shouldn't have been stories at all. But there we are. And that's why our word of the week this week is buyback.
Indeed, a good word of the week to wrap this episode up. And if you want full show notes for this, all the supplemental sources, links to the O'Donuts story, the O'Donuts Twitter account, you can find all that at westerncontext.ca. And you can also subscribe to the podcast with any number of podcast listeners out there, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Pocket Cast, practically anything under the sun at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Western Context. And with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode where we continue to provide all the information and context necessary that hopefully puts you, our listeners, on the right side of the news.
Yeah, and we'll always look through all the stories that the media talks about and some that they don't talk about to get to the real story of what's going on in Canada and to tell me what the media is not wanting to say and what they're not wanting to cover as we look through everything in TV, radio, print, online, you name it, we'll find it, and we'll always be able to give you the full context needed that you need to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.